Welcome back. It's season two of HugeCast. Like many of you, we're having to do things a little differently here at HugeCast HQ, which means we're recording our guests remotely instead of in our own studio, so you might notice a sound difference. But what hasn't changed is that we have some of the best guests to sit down and have a chat with us. Hold on to your hat and welcome to HugeCast season two.
What's the name of this podcast?
Eugene Cast.
How am I supposed to pronounce that?
OIGcast.
A huge cast.
Huge cast.
You're listening to
HugeCast.
Today I'm talking with Adam Wendt. We recorded this interview about racial justice a couple months ago, but since then, everything has changed. And so we wanted to talk about it again. So with that, I'd like to introduce my awesome HugeCast co-host, Adam Wendt. Thanks for doing this with me again.
Hi.
I know it's a hardship.
Not a hardship. No, it's great. I love talking with you. It's great. I do want to, if I could point something out from the intro.
Sure.
We talked a while ago, and the topic was centered around a lot of social justice conversation, but things really haven't changed since the last time we spoke. As far as the world out there is concerned, there's more awareness, it seems now, but the issues are still the same. African-American folks are still in the same situation and suffering from the same problems of systemic racism that they were before and have been for many, 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 many years. And so it's just really the thing that has changed is only our white perception of things and the world's perception of what's going on and the fact that people are now more aware of a significant discrimination and injustice that has been going on for many, many, many generations. And so
thank you for pointing that out. I really appreciate you pointing that out. And of course you're right. Of course you're right. You know, it's changed from the white perspective. But
right, yeah. And that's, I think that's the thing that's so exciting about what's going on right now. And I mean, that's one of the reasons why we wanted to talk again is because since the last time we had a conversation about racism and systemic racism and all that kind of stuff, demonstrations and the activation of this movement has happened that is extremely exciting to see happening. And there's something a lot different about it than they're used to. Than in the past, in ways that I think is important to acknowledge. I can't quite put my finger on some of it, but it just feels different, and that's great. But to have this conversation again, hopefully we can build off of what we talked about last time, which I'm meandering. I'm already meandering. Anyway,
that's okay.
Yeah.
We'll get you there. It was a really great conversation. I think it was like 4 months ago, which seems insane.
Yeah.
Cause I have no sense of time now, but, we had a different conversation back then. It was broader instead of more personal. And if it's okay with you, I'd like to bring it down to the personal.
Okay.
You are a father of three black children, I want to know what it's like for you, and I want to know if what you see it's like for them, or you know where you're at with all of this.
That's a good one. Well, you know, my kids, they're teens and in their early 20s. I am not African American, but they are. The personal aspect of what's going on today, and I think we broached this when we talked earlier, was that I have to have conversations with my kids about things that I never had to have conversations about with my parents. And the thing is that most white parents and families of they don't have to have this conversation with their kids about, well, you know, basically, like, for example, if my kid's going over to the mall by himself, you know, I'm afraid that some security guard who's got a chip on his shoulder is going to end up getting up in my kid's face. And my kid's got an uncanny sense of personal justice. If he feels like somebody's doing him wrong, he will mm-hmm. call them out on it. And he will confront them about the injustice. And I have to have conversations with my kid about, like, being careful. Because when people in authority, like a security guard, let's say at the mall, who's got a chip on his shoulder or having a bad day or just is a jackass, pardon my French. Yeah.
that never happens. Come on.
Sees my 14-year-old kid do some 14-year-old kid stupid kid thing that probably was not the wisest thing to do and potentially is going to get him in trouble. But to have that turn violent, to have that turn deadly, is a concern that and a conversation that I can guarantee you I can't guarantee it, but every family, every African American parent of an African American kid out there in the world has had this conversation and probably numerous times about the 411 on the 50, because the stuff that you've seen, you know, that we've all seen over the last many years here of cell phone cameras capturing what I consider to be criminal behavior on the part of the police departments in these particular situations.
Yeah, agreed.
When you see those things happening and you realize that the only reason we're seeing it is not because it's now happening and it never did before. It's always happened. It has always been a problem. And when you've got a kid and you're worried about them out in the world, that they're going to be treated differently, that they're going to be misunderstood. You know, my 14-year-old, he's 14, okay? His brain is 14.
Yeah.
But his body is 6'4". And he is, he looks older to people. He gets mistaken for a college student.
Wow.
Okay. He's 14. Right. And he's got a 14-year-old personality, you know, but that's the kind of thing that people can misunderstand.
Sure.
Because they're not used to him. They don't know him. They're not used to seeing a person like him. And so they can't gauge where things are. I mean, that's the kind of thing. If there's one thing that has been the hardest thing for me to understand, it's that aspect of helping my kids navigate something that I've never had to deal with.
Yeah.
And it's a reality. It's
Well, yeah, and you were also, weren't you, you're from Wyoming, right? So not like you grew up in a large community with lots of diversity and people of color. So
right. Yeah. You know, there were from what I remember, I think there was two African American families that lived in the town where I grew up. Or went to high school. And I didn't think twice about it, you know. But I definitely realized when I moved out here and to Boston, I lived in Boston for a little while, how incredibly, what's the word? It's not stupid, naive. Yeah, naive.
Oh, talking about yourself.
Yeah, how naive I was about race. Culture, the African American experience in this country. Yeah. I had no idea. They didn't teach us that stuff in school. They did not teach us about great African American authors or the struggle of post Civil War African Americans that were basically criminalized and put into the criminal justice system in order to continue to force labor in labor camps and work farms and stuff in the South. Jim Crow laws that were constructed in order to basically get African Americans into the criminal justice system so that they would lose their rights to vote as part of the 13th Amendment and lose their ability to be free. And to have the criminal justice system in the United States be a mechanism of oppression is, and to have it be that way for now going on 160 years is a major problem. And here's the thing. This is something that has been kind of bandied about by everybody, and as they talk about the defunding police and they talk about reparations and all these different things, is we as a society never came to terms with the fact that we as a society enslaved people. And then after we fought a war and after the change from it being legal to not being legal to own another human being in this country, after that Civil War, during Reconstruction, we never made things right. You know, the economics at the time of being in a post-war society that needed to reconstruct, and then we had all of these folks that are now free, okay? And they weren't, and the war was, how do I say this? We as a society never came through for those folks and made it so that they were truly part of this country and given an opportunity. We just constantly keep putting them down, and it's and I'm not saying we as in we right now. I'm saying that generation after generation after the Civil War has passed the buck to the next generation to make things right. And we never have. And so it is our job right now. Every single person who is alive and a citizen of this country right now needs to admit to themselves that there are things that we need to come to terms with. There are changes that need to be made. And there are things that we need to do to get things right. And that it's not going to take one generation putting it on one generation to do it. It's going to take many generations of a lot of work and a lot of effort on the part of the people in this country and leadership and the citizens of this country to make things right. Because we enslaved people. Our ancestors enslaved people. Not mine, but I have to take ownership of that as a person, as a white person in this country. And we have to take ownership of the things that the past generations have not owned up to. And so, yeah, it's...
Well, it's time for, again, this is my opinion, it's time for white Americans to look in the mirror and go, it's my problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, I said this to somebody else the other day. I said, just like rape and sexual assault is not a women's issue, it's a man's issue. Women are the victims. Same with systemic racism.
Yeah.
It's a white people's issue. And you're right. We've never in the history of the United States have we apologized for enslaving people. Never. We haven't apologized for killing the indigenous population. It's it's time to like look in the mirror and go, we did that. And we have to start fixing it. At least that, again, that's my point of view, and that's where I'm coming from now. And yes, I'm late to the party. I'm always late to the party, but
it's okay. At least you're at the party. Yeah, you're there. And the question is, are you mingling, or are you, you know, sitting on the sidelines waiting to dance? at waiting for somebody to ask you to dance, or you know, that's the stuff that everybody has to make a decision right now, where they're going to stand on these issues.
Yeah.
And we need to start moving forward and putting things in place that are going to correct generation after generation of misdeed. Because the atrocity of slavery did not end after the Civil War. It just kept going. We just passed the buck to the next group.
Right. You know? And it's still going. It's still going. So what do you think white people can do right now to start, you know, taking the ownership of it and going, I'm going to do my part. I'm never good at telling people what they should be doing, because everybody's different, but give us some ideas. Cause I've heard that a lot. I just don't know what to do. And I'm like, well, there's about a bajillion things that you can do, but you have to decide what it is that you want to do.
Right.
So some ideas.
Well, man, that is a tough question.
That's why you come to my interview, baby. I only ask the hard ones.
I know. God, Barbara Walters. I thought that was talking to JoJo. gosh. Well, you know, one of the things, you know, in the most simplest form of things is vote. And vote for people. Vote for leaders who are diverse, who have diverse opinions and ideas, who respect that the idea that people are different. The second thing is we need criminal justice reform in this country badly. Yes, I know we passed a big criminal justice reform bill last year. It's not adequate. Okay.
It's not enough. No.
The way the district attorney's offices have to plea and request plea deals for various people. They trade off people's rights in order to prevent a backlog in the legal system. I mean, if every single case went to trial, we would be backed up for 20 years. I mean, I don't know. I'm pulling that 20-year number out of it. But we would be backed up. The legal system would be backed up for years. It would not be quick. Not that it's quick now. But the fact that that prosecutors cut deals with people that didn't commit a crime. And the reason that they cut that deal
is... But don't you think also...
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, also, I think part of criminal justice reform is the over policing of communities of color.
Oh yeah.
It's an over policing, and we have, well, that, and you know, it just the, what do they call it? The prison industrial complex where people are making money hand over fist, like putting people in jail. Mm-hmm. Like that is just full on straight up bullshit.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, if that was happening to white people, to the extent that it's happening to black people, it wouldn't happen.
Yeah. And that's the other issue, is that white people need to acknowledge that when you come across something that would be different because of the color of your skin, you got to fight back against that. You have to, you have to push back against that. And that is a lot harder to do than it is to say, because that means you have to, as a person, no matter who you are, sacrifice something for someone else that you may not even know, or a group of people that you may not know. It's like giving up a seat on the bus for the person who is having difficulty getting on the bus. Okay. Like, we're all on a bus and we think that we're all equal on the bus, but we're not. Yeah. And until we all give a little bit of ourselves to make sure that people are on the bus and heading in the same direction we are, there's people that are hanging on to the outside of the damn bus, and we think they're on the bus with us. And that's not the case. That's not it. And so, I think, you know, to come back around to your question around what can we do, getting involved in organizations that support social and racial justice issues is important. And when I say get involved, that means don't get involved and try to take over.
Yeah.
There are a lot of folks who have been working on these issues for a long time. They know what's going on. They know what needs to happen, and you need to listen. So people, we need to listen to the folks out there who have not been heard. And if you're going to get involved in any kind of an organization that's supporting social justice, make sure you ask questions and don't be afraid to stick your foot in your mouth and say something wrong. Like, I'm sure after this interview is done, I could probably sit down and listen to this interview and catch myself saying something in a way that isn't necessarily what I mean, but it's the way it came out. Yeah. And that's a reflection of the way my brain's wired. And I acknowledge that. And so when you come across those, when people come across those thoughts, point them out to yourself, acknowledge them, ask yourself where that thought is coming from. If I'm driving down the road and I see someone walking along, like, you know, I think I told this story in our previous interview where I used to live in the Whitaker neighborhood, and back in the 90s, there was a major heroin epidemic. There was just a lot of people doing heroin and addicted to heroin, and a lot of it was coming in from this kind of Latino kind of connections and all these kinds of things. And there was a certain point in the 90s, and I wasn't as aware as I am now, and I'm still not as aware as I should be, but I caught myself one day driving down the street, and I saw a Hispanic guy walking down the road, down the sidewalk, and I immediately thought heroin dealer.
Wow.
And I caught myself thinking that, and I went, what the f-? You don't know that guy. What do you do? What is making you think like that? And it's all of the experiences that we have coming together to help our brains make sense of stuff, right? There's this idea, you know, like what I liken is that we're all biased, okay? There is not a single person, black, white, Hispanic, any of that, that is not biased in some way, shape, or form, okay? And the reason is because our brains, as wonderful and complex as they are unable to piece together all of the details about every single situation in its complete form before we open our mouths and before we make decisions. Okay.
Right. And it's the lens, right? It's the lens that we've always looked through.
Right. And it's kind of like, it's the idea of perception. Like, you know, that your eyeball, you only actually see like a majority of the stuff that's around you, but the peripheral stuff that you see when you're looking out, all your peripheral is all created by your brain.
Oh, wow. Cool.
And it's because it's about your brain processing information and saying, ah, most of all this other stuff out on this outskirts is unimportant, so I'm going to fill it in with what I think is there and stay focused on the thing that I'm focusing on. And it's that type of perception, and the brain does the same thing when it comes to when we are trying to figure out if we know someone or if we don't know someone or what someone's about or why we don't like someone or why we do like someone. All of those situations involve our brains taking in information and then trying to piece together an image from incomplete data. And that is why bias is there. You know, that's why we all have biases, because our brain is tricking us into thinking things And because of, like you said, how we were raised, what we were been exposed to, and experiences that we've had in the past. And Vice President of Equity and Inclusion at the university, Dr. Ascenso, when she first arrived at the University of Oregon, she put on a conference. It was an implicit bias conference, and she invited this wonderful speaker from the East Coast to come out. And I can't remember the name of this gal off the top of my head. But she presented a bunch of different scenarios using scientific experiments to explain and to show, visualize, and experience how our brains trick us into piecing together decisions and information in an incomplete manner to come to the wrong conclusion. And if anybody's listening wants to check it out, if you go on to YouTube and just pull up the McGurk effect, the McGurk effect. Yeah. So what the McGurk effect is, it is a phenomena where if you are looking at someone saying, I think like the word fa,
right.
Fa, what do you think I'm saying right there?
Oh, you know, I've seen this study. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you're looking at me, say it, I'm saying one thing. But if you close your eyes and I say the same thing, it sounds different.
Different. Yeah.
And it's as what I encourage people to do is expose yourself to those physical and mental and visual phenomena that help you understand how your brain pieces together information, because it's a great way of illustrating the situation around race and racial bias because of the generations of people learning and experiencing and engaging and interacting with people who are different and piecing together an understanding, an incomplete understanding of who and what people are.
Well, and I think you said this a while back where it's the awareness of, it's the awareness of our racism, our, like our personal racism. It's the awareness of our lens. And again, speaking for myself, I have found that to be incredibly helpful and important as I do my work now in racism and implicit bias and white fragility and all the things now. And the best thing I have is my awareness of it as these racist thoughts pop into my head, and I'm not that shocked by them actually, because it was, you know, a white person growing up in America. And you know, the parents that I have, neither of them would have said that they are overtly racist. And it was our country. Mm-hmm. It is our country. Mm-hmm. And so as these things pop up for me, I am grateful for the awarenesses that come. Are they comfortable? Not so much.
Well, that's the other thing. One of the things that people can do to help is, get ready to be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Try to get comfortable being uncomfortable, being in uncomfortable situations, having very uncomfortable conversations, having awkward moments where you don't know what to say properly. Do I call them black or are they African Americans? Oh my gosh, you know, or all these different things. Well, you know, all those things are different. Like if I talked to one friend of mine and I said, hey, you're an African American, she'd say, no, I ain't an African American. I ain't never been to Africa. I am black. Okay.
Yeah.
But then I talk to another friend of mine and they'll be like, you know what? I'm African American. When you say black, okay, whatever.
Sure.
So be ready to say, I'm sorry. My apologies. I didn't intend any bad vibe there. Thank you for letting me know. That's how you want to be. It's kind of like his, hers, they, them, all that kind of stuff that everybody's doing. It's like, those are the things, is that a lot of times you'll find, actually, I want to say this, because this is the thing that just irritates the hell out of me.
Preach.
Here we go. The one thing that folks, white folks, can do to be helpful would to stop becoming outraged over shit that is not theirs. Okay? It's okay to help, to be an ally, to support folks, to help as much as you possibly can. But this whole outrage thing where, like, folks are calling people out for saying the wrong thing accidentally. Stop that shit. Call them out, but quit being so damn outraged about it. You know? Like...
Give me another example, or five examples.
Okay. Oh, my God.
You know, and this is why examples are good. Because sometimes being completely clueless, we don't know. We don't know.
Right.
And... you know, it helps to go, oh, yeah. I mean, that's why I like reading the books that I'm reading. I'm like, I see myself in that example. So examples are really helpful. So thank you in advance.
Let's see if I can think of one. Let's say that in a lovely town like Eugene, where there's not a lot of diversity, that... let's say the local, university student newspaper published a photograph that was a photograph of one of the clubs on campus, and there were no people of color in the photograph. And suddenly, the letters to the editor in the Emerald the next week are full of people calling on the university to figure out some way to make, you know, things right, because this club at the university is just all, you know, there's no diversity in their diversity of opinion. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Let's call that out and be like, hey, it'd be really, you know, there's this, we should be striving for a little bit more diversity here. And so what can you do to do that? But to get outraged publicly, to call people out, this name calling thing that's been happening where people are calling people racists. Okay. Listen, when someone is naive about the terminology, when someone is naive about the perspective because they were raised a different way and they're learning and they're trying to learn, when they are biased, because everybody's biased. Okay. Everybody is some degree biased.
Yeah. Just own that shit.
They can own it, and you can push back on that, but don't be outraged about it. Don't call somebody a racist when all they're being is biased. Yeah. You know, to me, the racist aspect of it is when someone actively and consciously acts on their biases to discriminate against someone else, to cause harm to someone else, consciously and actively. Yeah. Okay, you know, that is an actionable thing where someone is consciously making an effort to point out and see those differences and make sure that those differences are unequal. Okay. That there's no equity there. Okay. This idea that, I've spoken with a lot of African-Americans, and friends of mine about this issue of when people are afraid to say things because they don't know what to say. They're afraid they're going to say something that's going to insult someone. Uh-huh. And the more we continually, as white folks, get on our white brothers and sisters and other folks around calling them out on these things in a disrespectful way, it's not helping. that
right.
person.
It's going to make them shut down more.
It's not going to help that person come to the place they need to be accepting and to acknowledge and be aware of their bias. It's going to formally create, it's going to form that bias more in their brain if they're confronted aggressively. And, you know, the other part of that is that you have to give people an opportunity to make amends, right?
Yeah. And we are human after all. Mistakes are going to be made.
Yes.
You know, shit's going to be said. It's not the mistakes you make. It's how you deal with it once those things are done.
Right. Especially if someone calls you out in a respectful way.
Yeah.
And you go, oh, God, I never really thought about it that way. And this is coming from a guy who's had a lot of conversations with people where they were already putting a frame around me. They were looking at me and going, oh, look at this guy. Yeah. And then they start using some language or whatever. You know, I was like hanging out with some friends of mine, and then they say something and I go, oh, hey, just, not cool. You know, think about what you just said there, because that's not really gonna work in my world. And you might want to think twice about how you're thinking about that. You know, I don't know. That's probably not the best way to say it to somebody if they're saying something that's racially insensitive or an off-color joke or a sexist comment or whatever, you know?
Well, but I do think that goes back to, like, what can people do is also, though, to, I mean, maybe not the vitriol, but definitely call it out when you see it. Yeah. I mean, the oldest jokes about Thanksgiving, you know, there's always the drunk uncle who is going to say a bunch of racist shit, and most people won't. You know, they'll just be quiet about it. I'm like, well, now's the time to start speaking up.
Yeah, even now call that shit.
If it's call that shit out. And
my mom was an active participant in pushing back on that stuff, because I had a step grandfather who was full on racist.
Yeah,
he would just go on and on at Thanksgiving time with the just nasty stuff. And my mom would fight with him, you know, and back when I remember when I was a kid, I was like, oh God, they used to get into these knockdown, drag out arguments about things that I didn't care about. And now when I look back on those, I go, wow, you know, that was a pretty progressive, you know, ranch gal there. Go to it there, rancher. I agree with you that in a way, the way we speak with each other, the way we address each other, right, is important. Am I gonna drive down River Road and there's the guy that drives around in the pickup truck with the Confederate flag flying off the back, and it's not a small flag. That's racism. Okay, that person is intentionally celebrating slavery. Okay.
Yeah.
Offending people purposely. If that person doesn't know that flag is bad, bad mojo, bad everything, and represents disrespectful, you know, it's just disrespectful.
It's the emblem of racism.
I'm not going to drive. I'm not going to drive down the road, see the guy, and pull him over and get into a fight with him. Okay.
No, but I also want to point out too that we're in Oregon. Like, I don't give a shit where your ancestors are from. Like, that has no business being here. Right. I mean, for a number of reasons, but it's like, we're in Oregon, you know? It's like, ugh, I don't know, very frustrating.
Well, let me tie into what I just said, because if I left off what I just said, where I said it, that's a pretty privileged statement that I made. I see someone with a Confederate flag flying off the back of their pickup truck, am not going to pull them over and confront them about it. Okay?
Right.
If anybody should, I should.
Right.
Okay? Those are the things that we should be doing. People think we should be doing them, and sometimes, yes, we should. We should be pushing back on that stuff when we can and when the time is... And I was about to say when the time is right. The time is always right. It's about the tone.
Well, and it's also timing. Instead of the time is right, it's about timing.
Yeah. But I mean, in a way, that's also, there's timing that's generational. Okay.
Sure.
Like, I heard a member of my family, extended family, in a phone call a few weeks ago, offhandedly, he was talking about a book he was reading, and he was talking about how, well, that was that colored feller up there at the blah, 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 you know, and he was talking about back in the turn of the century, the, you know, the 19th century to the 20th century. And he was talking about some dude got assassinated and something from by the Stockman's Association or whatever in Wyoming and all this stuff. And it was the colored fellow that lived up on the Granger thing. And he kept referring to the colored fella. And I said, you know, not the right phrase to use. That's not the common term. Yeah. It was back when you were in the 1930s, but it wasn't, you know, it's not right to say that now. And so, you know, having a conversation with a person in their 80s or 90s, the time has to be right. I mean, it's about calling awareness to things without, you're not going to, well, you're not going to change their mind by fighting.
Yeah. An old that's dog. True.
Okay.
And I've tried, I've really tried.
You know, and I'm going to tell a story that my family is going to be irritated that I'm going to tell, because it doesn't reflect well on a person who I love dearly. My grandmother, who lived to be, I think it was 100 and something, 100, wow. 100, 101, I don't know, somewhere in there. When she was in her 90s, I was back in Wyoming visiting, and my kids were playing with my cousin's kids at my aunt's house. And my grandma was sitting next to me on the couch watching the kids play. And she turns to me and she says, "I don't trust black people." Mm. And I said to her, I said, "Grandma, those are my children. Those are your grandchildren." She goes, "I know, but I can't figure out why I don't trust them." And she was speaking in the big sense of things. And I kind of left that because I knew I would come back around to her the next day. But so the next day, I go over to visit my grandmother. And I said, before I could even open my mouth, she sits me down and she says, "I am sorry for what I said yesterday." And I said, don't be sorry for saying it, because you also said you don't know why. You're processing something that is very new to you. She obviously never had any exposure to people of color. She had no exposure to people from different walks of life, even though she was living in the town of, I don't know, something like 75 nationalities or something like that. But most of that was that she just was not aware of how she was processing this thing that after 95 years, she's sitting there looking at her grandkids and they're black. What the, happened, you know? And that's just, but she apologized. We talked about it. We talked it through. We talked about why she feels that way and where that comes from. And that would not have happened if the night before I became outraged. "Grandma, how could you say that? I'm leaving." You know, if I had done any of that, that would have been the end of helping someone start to kind of understand how to process things that they've never had to process before. And we all need to do that now. We all need to give each other the space to work through these very complicated issues that have to do with beyond anything that we've encountered. And we also have to acknowledge that the African-American community has been dealing with these issues forever.
Forever.
Okay. And they are dealing with different things that we will never be able to understand. We will never. And all we can do is try and work on it and work on it and work on it. But it may take my entire life. And I'm saying this as a guy who is the parent of African-American children, that I am probably going to spend my entire life trying to figure out how to be a better person around this issue. Because I was raised, and I have things that are deep that I don't even know I have going on in there. And all I can do is just keep working on them and keep helping, keep being an ally, keep working on behalf of the community, supporting my children's ability to try to navigate this incredible world that we're in right now. With all the stuff that's going on right now. I mean, you know, number one, you know, another big thing that white folks need to, and well, just anybody who's not a person of color needs to acknowledge is that, and I'm about to do the same thing that I'm about to tell people not to do, which is I am lumping all white people together into a single monolithic group. Okay. What
all
I'm about
white
to say
people
is,
are.
Right, is don't think of race as some sort of monolithic, everybody's like moving in, thinking the same, in the same ways and all of those things, because there tends to be this thing where it's like, oh, well, you know, I'm not racist because I, you know, this and I'm that and I know all these things and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, you might not be, you know, exhibiting racist behavior, but you're biased. Acknowledge your bias. If you're not acknowledging your bias, then you are being racist, because it's just true. And if you are trying to lump an entire demographic grouping or cultural grouping in and thinking that everybody is this monolithic thing, thinking the same way, you're wrong and you're being racist. And so everybody has to look at themselves as an individual and acknowledge and come to terms with how they think about other people. And I hope and I encourage everybody to just be kind and human when you address things. Conflict is a thing. It's part of life. And we're going to have situations and we're going to communicate about things where we're going to be in conflict. You know, like I said, people have looked at me and considered me just this monolithic thing. You know, like, oh, there's just another white dude, you know. And sure, I exhibit a lot of the behaviors that, you know, are common in a white fellow. I speak like this and all that kind of stuff, you know. And but at the same time, I'm also, I've been, you know, as an adoptive parent, I've had people look at me because I had long hair and be like, oh, so you're like anti-gun, anti-abortion and all this kind of stuff, blah, 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 or whatever. You know, I don't know. You can lump all these things together and you don't know that about people. It's just like the Hispanic fella walking down the road and me going, why did I just think that? That's the question we constantly be having to ask ourselves. Why did I just think that? You know?
So from the things that we've been talking about, let me see if I can do a quick review. The first thing that people that are interested in social justice and bias and racism, mm-hmm. and the first thing that they can do is really start with themselves. Is that correct?
I would say that's a pretty good place to start.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's true of all awarenesses and learning and growing, and your curiosity has to start with you. And so I don't know. We're kind of winding down our time here.
Right.
And so,
well, I did want to say that it is being aware of yourself, but also listening. to others and letting, giving people the space to be able to speak and express themselves and tell you how they are and what's going on and what's bothering them. And giving people the space to be able to call you out on things.
Yeah, and don't get butt hurt when they do.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's part of our growth thing here. But as people become more interested in looking at their own cultural bias, you know, having a little compassion for ourselves, too.
Yeah.
As this stuff pops up, I would say it's a practice mentality. You know what I mean? It's you just got to have some compassion for where you are with an eye to where you want to go.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's, you might not be able to get that eye to where you want to go.
Yeah.
You might not be able to see that in the distance, because I don't think we ever reach it. I really don't. I don't think we, I think that it's a lifelong process of getting to know how you think, how you feel, and why, and then exposing yourself to new opportunities and experiences that will help you get more of an understanding of how other people operate. I've got a sign on my door here when I don't want to be disturbed. It says, walk a mile before you judge someone, walk a mile in their shoes, because, let's see, what is it? I got better look up. It's on my fucking door. It says,
Cliff Notes. You need some.
Cliff Notes. It says, before you criticize someone, you should walk a mile in their shoes. Yeah, that's right. That's how it is. You've heard that phrase, right? Before you criticize, before you criticize someone, you should walk a mile in their shoes.
Yeah.
Well, this, the second part to that that's on my door says, because you'll be a mile away and you'll have their shoes when you criticize them. So, but it's
there
that.
There was wisdom in there somewhere.
Yeah, and then I finished it with no wisdom. But there's that aspect of it is that we do not put ourselves in the shoes of others enough.
That's true.
To know. And we're not going to truly know what people are going through, okay? Like, if I was to say, oh, hey, let's talk about the Central Park Five, right? People can say, whoa, that was a tragedy. No, that was criminal.
Yeah.
What the criminal justice system did to those young men was wrong. And I can put myself... I can imagine what it was like to be falsely accused, interrogated, and then basically, charged with the rape and murder of someone, and then sent to prison for a crime that you did not commit, okay?
Yeah.
I can't even imagine. I mean, I can start to try to imagine, but I cannot fathom the full aspect of that, and there are... thousands and thousands and thousands of people in the criminal justice system today that are serving sentences for things they did not do, or serving sentences that are way out of line, way out of line with what crime they committed as a justifiable thing. I mean, you know, read Just Mercy. You know that book, Just Mercy?
Yeah.
Oh, I think. Yeah. Oh, is that right? Excellent book that really has some... You get to see the criminal justice system from all these unique perspectives. And from the tale of a person who was representing those people as their attorney. And, and he, it's such a good book. I mean, I highly recommend that one. It's very good. The movie, I don't know if I've seen that movie. I should see that. It's got Michael Jordan in it. Am I right? Michael P. Jordan.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh, well, but yes.
Well,
okay.
Well, thanks for, for all of this stuff to think about, chew on, investigate, go look for all the things. Because I know that like an hour talking about this is hardly enough.
Has it been an hour?
Thank you for taking the time and at least getting me started and maybe somebody else started. So it all counts. It all counts.
Right. You're very welcome, Jojo. It's always nice to talk to you. And I'm looking forward to talking to you and interviewing you. I was going to interview you about the stuff you were into, but now that's all done. I do want to say that if anybody listens to this and they want to get, they want to make a comment, please go ahead. You can send an email to the HugeCast email and they will get it to me because I'm on the team.
Absolutely.
If anybody wants to be outraged, please do that. You can
send
that email to the president of the United States. He cares about that. But if you do, you know, want to comment or if I, you know, I'm not saying that everything I say is right.
Yeah.
All I can say is everything that I'm trying to do is move forward and try to help. That's, you know, and that's all we can do. And just always be learning. Always
awesome.
Be learning.
Yeah. Always be learning. Well, that's going to do it for us. But thanks again for having another conversation with me about this. I totally appreciate it. And thanks for kicking off season two.
I'm kicking off season two. And you're welcome, Jojo. Thank you.
Whoop, whoop, whoop. I'll talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye.
And now for some housekeeping. HugeCast would like to thank its contributors, volunteers, and sponsors. A huge thanks goes out to Mark Davis at Eugene Tech for providing guidance and enthusiasm, to Trifoya for providing equipment, space, beverages, and the occasional pizza, and to That Supergirl for providing web hosting. Our producer is Kimberly Noel. Music and soundscapes conceived by Mike Jones. Audio editors include Mike Jones and Christopher Mitchell. Audio engineer is Christopher Mitchell. HugeCast hosts are the amazing Adam Wendt and the delightful Jojo Jensen. If you like what you hear, please give us a review. 5 stars would be nice. And who knows, we might even read your comments during the show. So thanks for listening, or sleeping through it. Either way, thanks.